But we weren't friends. I met Fiona after they divorced, so I tend to side with her. I'm polite when I run into him, but that's about it. Joel's on the phone at the moment, but I'll take you up to the office as soon as he's done. Would you like a look around? That'd be great. We're doing this piecemeal. Not my preference. Fiona and I wanted to do it all at once. A full installation, which is so much more dramatic and lots more fun. But Joel put his foot down, so we're doing the job in stages. This is the living room, obviously. She rattled off the rooms as I followed along behind. Sunroom, den, formal dining room. The kitchen's in there. Joel's office is in what we call the crow's nest upstairs. The rooms were clearly in transition. The floors were covered with palace-sized oriental carpets, probably quite old to judge from the softness of the colors and intricate designs. The furniture, which I assumed was chosen by the deceased Mrs. Glazer, appeared to be almost entirely antique, with massive armoires and occasional pieces in polished mahogany. The few upholstered pieces were done in white linen, the lines clean and clear. A variety of fabric swatches had been draped across the chairs, and 2-inch samples of paint colors had been taped in various places on the wall. Some of the upholstery fabric I hadn't seen since my youth, when my Aunt Jin would take me to visit her friends. Jungle prints, fakey-looking leopard skin, banana palms, bamboo, zigzags, and chevrons in shades of orange and yellow. The wall paint under consideration was that noxious shade of green that marked most 1930s bathrooms when they hadn't been done in an oh-so-modern mix of pink and black. She's found us a sharpskin-top room and desk for this wall with an André Groult mirror. We're thrilled about that. I can imagine, I murmured. I could see where Fiona's Art Deco taste wouldn't be completely out of place, but I couldn't for the life of me picture these cool, elegant rooms redone in black lacquer, plastic, leather, enamel, curly maple, and chrome. Dana was saying, Joel was widowed 4 years ago. He lived here with his wife for the past 22 years. The truth is, I'd love to level it, but he can't see the point. Good for him, I thought. How's Michael? I was afraid to ask about her younger son, Brian, because the last time I'd seen him, he was on his way back to jail. He and Brendan are fine. Juliet left. I guess she got tired of marriage and motherhood. Too bad. Well, she said briskly, let me check and see if Joel's off the phone. I realized she was as eager as I to avoid talk of Brian. She moved to an intercom in the dining room, pressing a button that apparently rang through to Joel's office. Sweetie, are you free? I heard his muffled reply. She turned with a smile. He says to come right on up. I'll walk you to the elevator. Maybe we can chat when you've finished your talk with him. I'd like that. Chapter 9. Joel Glazer's office was located on the 3rd floor, a spacious, airy tower room with windows on all 4 sides. There were no curtains or drapes, but I could see narrow blinds pulled up to the tops of the panes to permit maximum light. His views were spectacular. The ocean, the coastline, the mountains, and the western edges of Horton Ravine. The thickened cloud cover spread gloom across the landscape, at the same time making the deep blue of the mountains and the dark green of the vegetation seem more intense. In place of a desk, he used a heavy refectory table. All the other pieces of furniture were antiques, except for the 7-foot sofa, done in a tailored rust-covered velvet with white piping along the seams. As in the rooms below, the area rug was an oversized oriental carpet, probably 17 feet by 23. Because of the extended use of windows, there was no artwork to speak of. Bookcases and file drawers were built along the walls from the windowsills down. The office was not only immaculate, but orderly. Everything arranged just so. The edges of the papers and documents on his desk were squared, pencils and pens lined up parallel to the blotter. Joel Glazer rose to greet me, and the two of us shook hands. His looks surprised me. I was so enamored of Dana Jaffe's beauty that I'd imagined a mate for her equally good-looking. My reaction to Joel was much like mine when I first saw the photographs of Jackie Kennedy and Aristotle Onassis, the princess and the frog. Joel was in his 60s with a high, balding forehead, his once fair hair turning a tawny shade of gray along his temples. Behind frameless glasses, his eyes were brown, with heavy creases near the outer corners. His mouth was bracketed with deep lines. When he stood up to greet me, I realized he was shorter than I, probably only 5'4". He was portly, and his shoulders were hunched in a way that made me want to monitor my calcium intake. His smile revealed a gap between his two front teeth, which were discolored and slightly askew. He wore a fresh white dress shirt with a pair of flashy cufflinks, his suit jacket arranged neatly over the back of his chair. I picked up the faint citrus of his aftershave. "Nice to meet you, Miss Melhone. Have a seat. I understand you and my wife have a prior acquaintance." I settled into a brown leather wing chair that blended perfectly with the cream, beige, rust, and brown of the carpeting. "Seems like a long time ago," I said. I wasn't sure how much Dana had told him about her prior life, and most of that story seemed too complicated to summarize in conversation. He settled back in his chair, his right hand resting on the desk in front of him. He had a signet ring on the middle finger that glinted in the light. "No matter. You're actually here with regard to Dow. Fiona tells us she's hired you to track him down. I'll tell you what I can, but I'm not sure that's going to be much help." "I understand," I said. "Could we start with Pacific Meadows? I gather there's been a problem with the Medicare billing." "My fault entirely. I blame myself for that. I should have kept an unofficial eye on the day-to-day operations. Harvey Brodus and I, don't know if you've met him, my partner." I shook my head in the negative, allowing him to continue. "We've had a host of projects in the works this past 6 months. We've been partners for years. My background's business and finance, where his is real estate and construction, a match made in heaven. We met on the golf course 15 years ago and decided to go into partnership, building retirement communities, nursing homes, and board and care facilities. Both of us had parents who were deceased by then, but the need for attractive housing and skilled nursing care for the elderly was something we'd both struggled to find and not always was success. Anyway, long story short, we've now put together an impressive chain of residential health care and intermediate care facilities. Pacific Meadows we acquired in 1980. At the time, it was shabby and poorly run. We could see the potential, but the place was losing money hand over fist. We poured close to $1 million into the renovation and improvements, which included the new annex. Soon after that, we made the lease arrangement with Genesis Financial Management Services. Somebody, I forget now who, suggested Dow's name to Genesis as a possible administrator. I'd known him socially and could certainly vouch for his reputation in the medical community. He'd just retired from private practice and was looking for a way to occupy his time. Seemed like a worthwhile arrangement for all the parties concerned. What happened? I wish I knew. Harvey and I are often out of town, crisscrossing the state. We've probably taken on more than we should, but Harvey's like me. The two of us thrive on pressure. The phone on his desk began to ring. He glanced at it briefly. You need to get that? Dana will pick up. I should go back and fill you in, at least superficially, on how this business works. What you have essentially are three separate entities. Harvey and I own the property through Century Comprehensive, which is a company we formed back in 1971. By property, I'm talking now about the land and the building occupied by Pacific Meadows. The nursing home is actually operated by Genesis, as I've mentioned before. They lease the physical plant from us. They also handle all the billing, accounts payable and receivable, Medicare and Medicaid billing, DME purchases, that's durable medical equipment, in case you're wondering. Genesis falls under the larger umbrella of a company called Millennium Healthcare. Millennium is publicly held, and as such, they're required by law to submit financial information to Social Security. And by that, I mean lists of assets, liabilities, and the return on equity capital. A certified public accountant has to verify those figures. 10, 15 years ago, an owner and operator were often one and the same. But times have changed. By law, those functions now have to be separate and distinct. It's like a system of checks and balances, keeps everybody on the up and up. Where did Dr. Purcell fit in? I'm just getting to him. Under the management company, you have Dow, or his equivalent. He's the medical administrator of the facility, responsible for the day-in, day-out, nuts-and-bolts decisions, which is where he may have gotten into trouble. The three of you are partners? Not really. That's how Dow refers to us, but it's not technically true. For the layperson, it's the easiest explanation of our relationship. We couldn't be in partnership with Dow or the management company that runs the business. Believe me, the government gets very testy about any agreement that isn't the result of an arm's-length negotiation. In other words, two unrelated parties not in collusion with one another. Dow could hardly make unbiased decisions about billing practices if he stood to profit. What you're probably referring to is the fact he bought stock in Millennium Healthcare, which is a chain we also own stock in. I guess that makes us partners of a sort. We're all in the same business, which is service to the elderly in our community. Of course, we had no real say in the matter, but Harvey and I both thought Pacific Meadows would be the perfect venue for a man with Dow's experience and reputation. I see now he may not have had quite the head for business I'd been led to believe. The first we heard about this Medicare business was last May. I thought then, and I'm still convinced, any discrepancies would turn out to be simple clerical mistakes. A compilation of coding errors as opposed to actual inflation of the figures with any intent to defraud. Dow Purcell is just too fine a man to stoop to cheating in that way. My guess is he either didn't have a thorough understanding of how Medicare works, or he got impatient with all the nitpicking nonsense the bureaucrats put you through. I can't fault him for that. As a physician, his first thought is always going to be for the well-being of the patient. He might have bridled at seeing all the ridiculous amounts of paperwork get in the way of first-class care, or worse still, he may have felt the government had no right to dictate to him. So you think he might have bent the rules a bit? I prefer that explanation to the one the fraud control investigator seems to be taking. A better guess is he was careless, penciling approval on charges he should have examined more closely. The notion of Dowen actively debunking the government is incomprehensible. Suppose he did, though. I don't understand how he benefits. If Medicare or Medicaid is overbilled, aren't those monies paid to the operating company? Seems like it's really their responsibility, isn't it? Absolutely. But outside providers, such as ambulance companies and medical supply businesses, can collect thousands of dollars for services never rendered or goods not delivered or goods billed out at inflated prices. If someone in Dow's position were in league with them, the contracts could mean thousands of dollars to the companies involved. For this, he'd receive remuneration. A kickback. Perhaps under the heading of a professional discount or a referral fee. Now that HCFA, excuse all the acronyms, that's the Healthcare Financing Administration, which regulates Medicare and Medicaid programs, gets complicated, I remarked. Very. At any rate, now that HCFA has stepped in, they're insisting on documentation for every such transaction, including the lease agreement, which is where we come in.
But you don't think he's really guilty?
I don't. At the same time, it isn't looking good for him.
You think he left to avoid disgrace?
Possibly, he said. If he felt unable or unwilling to face the charges. I'm not sure how he'll deal with the humiliation if they decide to prosecute. I'm not sure how any of us would deal with that. He's a man in big trouble. I don't like to think of him as a coward as well.
When did you see him last? Do you remember the occasion?
Of course. September 12th, the day he disappeared. I took him out to lunch.
I didn't realize that. Oh, was this at his request or yours?
His. He called and asked to see me. Of course, I said yes. By then I knew about his difficulties. I had some other business in that part of town, so we met at a little place in walking distance of Pacific Meadows. Just a hole in the wall called Dickens, a mock English pub. It's quiet and affords a measure of privacy, which I knew he'd appreciate.
Did he talk about the problems with Medicare?
Not directly. He did ramble on a bit about the ongoing investigation. He was clearly upset. He seemed to want reassurances that Harvey and I would come to his defense. I did what I could to put his mind at rest, but I told him I couldn't condone anything underhanded. I don't mean to sound pompous, but in truth, if the charges turn out to be provable, then Dow's actions are not just unethical, they're illegal. As much as I like and admire the man, there's no way I'd be willing to cover for him, even if I could.
But why would he risk it? Especially at his age and station in life. He couldn't need the money.
I'm not so sure about that. Dow always did well for himself financially, but Crystal is high maintenance. She costs him a bundle. He has two houses to maintain. You know, he bought Crystal that beach house at her insistence. Nothing would do, but she had to have that place. Plus, he has Fiona's alimony, which is burdensome, to say the least. Crystal likes to travel, and she does it in style, including first-class airfare and accommodations for Griffith's nanny, along with everyone else. She's the kind of gal who insists on being gifted. Birthdays, anniversaries, Christmas, Valentine's Day. She expects to receive jewelry and nothing cheap. She makes sure of that. Dana's theory is she's busy accruing personal assets in case the bottom drops out.
The phone rang again. This time his eyes didn't even flicker, so I went right on. You think she married him for his money? He considered the question briefly and then shook his head.
I wouldn't say that. I think she genuinely loves the guy, but she's been poor all her life. She wants to make sure she's safe just in case something happens to him.
What about the rumors of an extramarital affair on her part?
You'd have to ask Dana. She's the one who spotted that piece of shenanigans. I prefer to steer clear.
Did Dr. Purcell say anything to suggest he might flee?
Joel shook his head. I don't remember anything of the kind. Is that the direction the police are leaning in?
Well, they can't rule it out. Apparently his passport and a substantial sum of money are missing.
Joel stared at me as though trying to take that in. If he ran, he'd have to continue running for the rest of his life.
Maybe that's not as bad as the alternative. From what you say, he was feeling desperate.
Exactly. He was horrified at the prospect of facing criminal penalties.
I talked to an attorney who thinks it wouldn't be that bad. He might have to pay restitution, but he wouldn't go to jail.
That wasn't his perception. He was deeply depressed. The government's getting tough. He knew they might well decide to make an example of him. More than anything, we're talking about the loss of face, something I'm not sure he could handle.
He paused, moving four pencils from one side of his table to the other. I saw his gaze shift. What's going through your mind?
He shook his head. Something I haven't dared say to anyone else. It crossed my mind, after seeing him that day, he might have been thinking of doing himself in. He was trying to cover his distress, but it might have been too much. He wasn't sure Crystal would stick with him once the scandal came to light. You have to ask yourself just how despondent he was, and how far he'd go to get relief. I should have asked how he felt. I should have done what I could to reassure him, but I didn't.
Joel. We both turned to find Dana standing in the doorway. Harvey's on line two. This is the second time he's called.
Sorry, I better get this.
Sure, go ahead. I appreciate your time. It's possible I'll want to talk to you again at a later date.
Any time, he said.
He stood up when I did, and the two of us shook hands across his desk. By the time I reached the door, he'd picked up the phone. Dana walked me to the elevator with its two-person capacity, the interior about the size of the average telephone booth. I could have run down the stairs in the time it took. During its slow, whirring descent, I said, "What's a story on Clint Augustine?"
Simple.
For the 6 months Augustine rented from us, Dow would go off to work, and the next thing you know, Crystal would come sneaking out her back door through the trees and into the cottage. She'd be there an hour or so and then slip back home. Meanwhile, Rand minded the baby, taking him for endless walks around Horton Ravine. It got to be the talk of the neighborhood. We reached the first floor foyer. Couldn't there be another explanation?
Dana's smile was jaded. Maybe they were having tea.
Santa Teresa Hospital, St. Terry's, is located on the Upper West Side, a neighborhood once devoted to open farmland, working vineyards, dairies, and stables, all with sweeping views to the mountains on the northern edge of town. Early black-and-white photographs of the area show wide, dusty roads, shanties flanked by groves of citrus and walnut trees, all leveled long ago. It's a world that appears curiously bald and flat. Rural expanses planted with pampas grass and star pines that look like mere sprigs. A few unpretentious structures from that era remain, tucked like vintage treasures among modern-day buildings. The rest, churches, the original county courthouse, the wooden boarding houses, the dry goods establishment, the early mission, the trolley car barn, and numerous snazzy three-story hotels were razed by intermittent earthquakes and fires, nature's demolition crews. It was not quite 2 o'clock when I parked on a side street and walked a block and a half to St. Terry's front entrance. The wind had picked up and the trees seemed restless, stirring uneasily. Occasionally, a miniature rain shower would shake loose from the upper branches. The very air seemed gray, and I was happy to pass into the hospital lobby through the sliding glass doors that parted at my approach. On my left, the coffee shop was sparsely occupied by hospital employees and visitors. I inquired at the information desk and was given directions to the office of the Director of Nursing Services. I passed a ladies' restroom and made a brief detour before I continued my quest. I found Penelope Delacourt in a small private office with a window looking out onto the street. Overhead fluorescent lights contrasted sharply with the gloom outside. She was seated at her desk, using her pencil point to trace the lines of print on a photocopied memorandum. When I knocked on the door frame, she peered at me above a pair of half-glasses with tortoiseshell frames. She was in her early 50s, at that stage where she hadn't quite decided whether to dye her graying hair. I pictured her in arguments with her hairdresser, unsure of herself when it came to permanent versus temporary rinses. They likely also argued about the cut. Penelope clinging to the shoulder-length page boy she'd probably been wearing for years. Her bangs were too short, and I wondered if she chopped them off herself between appointments. She removed her glasses and set them aside.
Yes? You're Ms. Delacourt? Yes.
Her attitude was cautious, as though I might be on the verge of serving her with papers. Kinsey Milhone, I said. I'm a private investigator here in town, and I've been hired to look into Dr. Purcell's disappearance. May I have a few minutes? Without much in the way of encouragement, I entered her office, slipped off my rain garb, and eased myself into the chair near her desk. My shoulder bag and the slicker I left in a pile at my feet. Penelope Delacourt got up and closed her office door. She didn't seem happy with my presence. She was close to 6 feet tall, slim, conservatively dressed, a navy blue coat dress with small brass buttons up the front. Her low-heeled navy blue pumps were plain and looked vaguely orthotic, as though prescribed for fallen arches or excessive pronation. She sat down and put her hands in her lap. I'm not sure what I can tell you. I was gone by the time he went missing. How long did you work for Pacific Meadows?
I was the administrator there for the past 8 years until August 23rd. I worked with Dr. Purcell for the last 47 months of that.
Her voice, like her manner, was carefully modulated, as though she'd set her internal dial to pleasant.
I thought he was the administrator. His title was medical director / administrator. I was the associate administrator. So I suppose you're correct. Can you tell me why you left?
Genesis, the management company that oversees the operation of Pacific Meadows, received notification that Medicare was conducting a rigorous audit of our records.
I raised my hand. What prompted them to do that? Do you have any idea?
Probably a complaint.
From?
One of the patients, a guardian, a disgruntled employee.
I'm not sure what it was, but they seemed to know what they were doing. Apparently, the clinic was suspected of any number of violations, from overpaying our suppliers to submitting false or inflated claims for services.
Dr. Purcell was in a panic and blamed the bookkeeper, Tina Bart, which was absurd and unfair. Ms. Bart was working for Pacific Meadows before I arrived, and she was faultless in her performance. I went to bat for her. I wasn't going to let them push it all off on her. She didn't make the decisions. She didn't even pay the bills. Genesis did that. She processed purchase orders and prepared the room and board bills for each resident, including central supply, therapy, anything other than medication. This was Medicare, Medicaid, HMOs, private insurance, and private pay. The same information crossed my desk as well. She didn't generate the paperwork. She forwarded what she was given. Why isn't Genesis considered responsible for the problem if they pay the bills? We supply them the information. As a rule, they don't stop to verify the data, nor did Ms. Bart. But she was fired anyway. Yes, she was. And I turned in my notice the very same day. I was determined to file a complaint with the Labor Relations Board. What was their response? I never got that far. I had second thoughts and decided not to go through with it. Tina Bart didn't want to make a fuss. She was as reluctant as I was to call attention to Dr. Purcell's situation. His situation? Well, yes. We're all fond of him. He's a darling human being and a wonderful doctor. If he didn't have a head for business, that wasn't an actionable offense, as far as we were concerned. I'm being candid in this. He just had no clue when it came to the Medicare rules and regulations. Which items were billable, and which would automatically be disallowed, co-payments, deductibles, claims for fee-based services. I grant you it's enormously complicated. Make one mistake, God forbid you put a code in the wrong place or leave even one window blank, and the form comes right back at you, usually without a hint about where you've erred. But Dr. Purcell didn't do the billing. Of course not. But it was his job to review the TARS. The TARS? The treatment authorization requests. He was also responsible for reviewing CPT codes and approving the cost of any ancillary services or DMEs. I have to emphasize he was always genuinely concerned and very innovative when it came to patient care and well-being. You don't have to work so hard to defend the man, I said. I'll take your word for it. What I hear you saying is when it came to the day-to-day management, he was incompetent. I suppose, though it seems too strong a word. Didn't Glazer and Brodus realize what was going on? It wasn't their place. They purchased the property from the previous owner, did extensive improvements, financed and built the annex. The rest was up to Genesis and Dr. Purcell. Please understand this is just my personal opinion, but I've worked with a number of doctors over the course of my career. It almost seems that the better a man is at the practice of medicine, the worse he is at business. Most of the doctors I know have a hard time admitting this about themselves. They're used to being gods. Their judgment is seldom questioned. They have no awareness of the limits they face, so they're easily duped. They may have medical knowledge, but often not an ounce of common sense when it comes to money management. At any rate, I didn't mean to digress. I'm just trying to explain how Dr. Purcell could have gotten himself into such a mess. Didn't you explain it to him? On numerous occasions. He seemed to listen and agree, but the errors continued to accrue. But if you suspected he was screwing up, couldn't you have gone to the operating company yourself? Over his head? Not if I wanted to keep my job. Which you lost anyway. Ms. Delacorte pressed her lips together, color warming her cheeks. I felt compelled to resign when Ms. Bart was fired. I said, do you think Dr. Purcell was intentionally cheating the government? I doubt it. I can't see how he'd benefit unless he had some covert arrangement with Genesis or the various providers. The point is, Dr. Purcell was on the premises. Genesis wasn't, and neither were Mr. Glazer or Mr. Brodus. It was his responsibility, and, ultimately, he's the one who'll be held to answer. What do you think happened to him? I can't answer that. I was gone by then. I'm still not clear why you didn't file a complaint. If Tina Bart was unlawfully terminated, wouldn't that constitute a legitimate grievance?
She was silent, and I could see her struggle with her reply.
I suppose we were both reluctant to get into a public battle.
With whom?
With anyone, she said.
Employment opportunities are limited in Santa Teresa. Talk travels fast, especially in medical circles. Despite the number of doctors, there are only 3 hospitals. Jobs at my level aren't easy to find. My roots here go deep. I've been in town close to 30 years. I can't afford to be labeled a troublemaker or a malcontent. You might consider that faint-hearted, but I'm a widow with an aging mother to support. Now I think I've given you all the information at my disposal, so if you'll excuse me.
She began to fuss with papers on her desk, lifting a stack and tamping the edges to even them up. Red patches, like moral hives, had begun to appear on her neck.
Just one more thing. Where did Tina Bart end up?
You're the detective. You figure it out.
Chapter 10. When I got back to the office, I picked up a message slip on which Jennifer had written, "Richard Heaven called. Please, P-L-E-A-S, return his call." I could actually feel my heart begin to thump as I moved down the corridor to my office and unlocked the door. I hadn't expected to hear from him until Wednesday at the earliest. I dumped my shoulder bag on the desk and snatched up the telephone. I got a wrong number twice before I realized that Jennifer had inverted the last 2 digits in the number she'd so laboriously copied. I reached Richard on the 3rd try, saying, "Richard, Kinsey Milhone returning your call."
"Oh, sure. Thanks for calling me back. How are you?"
"Fine. What can I do for you?"
Well, listen, I've been through the rest of these applicants and none of them panned out. Bunch of bums out there. The place is yours if you want it."
"Really? Well, that's great. I'm really happy about that. When can I take possession?"
"I'm heading over there now. If you have a few minutes, maybe you could give me a check. That's $1,675 with the cleaning deposit, made out to Heavener Properties."
"Sure, I could do that. I'm just across the alley. The building I'm in now looks right down on yours."
"I didn't realize that. Why don't you join me in a bit, and as soon as the lease is signed, I'll give you the key."
Like many people, he seemed to be uncomfortable discussing money, and I wondered how much experience he'd had in landlord-tenant relationships. "What time?"
10, 15 minutes."
"I'll see you shortly, and thanks." As soon as I hung up, I did a little dance of joy, my attention already darting forward to the practicalities of moving. Fortunately, I'd never completely unpacked in the 3 years since I'd landed at Kingman and Ives, so that would save time. Desk, chair, daybed, phony ficus plant. This was gonna be a snap. I could park in my own spot a mere 15 steps from my office door. I could eat lunches at the table on the redwood deck. I opened my closet door and hauled out the top 2 boxes, looking for my tape measure, which I found at the bottom of the 2nd box. The tape was one of those heavy-duty metal suckers, with a reel back so fast it would slice off your little finger if you didn't watch yourself. I tucked it in my shoulder bag, grabbed a yellow legal pad and pencil, made sure my message machine was on, then shrugged into my slicker and walked to my brand-new digs. I felt like skipping, and then I wondered if kids ever did that these days. I was already feeling extraordinarily possessive as I trotted along the driveway from the rear of the lot. While I could see the bungalow from Lonnie's office, I had to go halfway around the block and cut down the alleyway to reach the place. There were lights on throughout the bungalow, and by hopping up just once, I caught a glimpse of the CPA who occupied the front office. I'd have to take a moment to introduce myself when time allowed. I rounded the corner, noting a sedate-looking dark blue sedan that I assumed belonged to the CPA. Tommy's black pickup was parked 2 slots down. Once inside the back door, I was careful to wipe my feet on the shaggy cotton doormat provided for that purpose. The door to the back office was standing open, and I could smell fresh paint. I peered in and found Tommy on his hands and knees, touching up the baseboards with a brush and a can of white latex paint. He flashed me a quick smile and continued with his work. He was wearing a khaki-green coverall,
and I was struck again by the vibrancy of the picture he presented. By day, his red hair carried glints of copper, and a sheen of pale freckles seemed to make his skin ruddy. I said, "Hi, how are you?"
"Doing good. Thought I'd get this finished while I had the chance. I hear you're the new tenant."
"Well, it looks that way. Richard said he'd meet me over here to do the paperwork." There was something nice about the fact that his attention was fixed on the job in front of him. It allowed me to study his shoulders and the soft reddish hair on his forearms, where his sleeves were rolled up. I could see the lines in his knuckles where a fine bleed of white paint still clung to his skin. The hair along the back of his neck was in need of cutting and curled haphazardly. He glanced over his shoulder at me.
"Thought maybe you left. You're so quiet back there."
"I'm here." I moved over to the window just to have something to do.
"The deck's great."
Really, I was wondering if he had a girlfriend.
"I built that myself. I was thinking to add some trellising, but it seemed like overkill."
"Looks nice as it is. Is that redwood?"
"Yes, ma'am. Clear heart. I don't like cheap materials. Richard bitches about that, but I figure in the end it'll save us money. Anything cheap you end up doing twice."
I couldn't think of anything to add to that. I cranked the window open and cranked it shut again. Idly, I lifted the telephone handset. I could hear a dial tone.
"You got a call to make?"
I just wondered if it worked. I guess I'll have to talk to the phone company and have the service switched.
"How's the boyfriend?"
"He's fine." Another pause while Tommy dipped the brush in the can.
"Hope he's treating you good."
"Actually, he's out of town." I winced when I said it because it sounded like a come-on.
"What's he do for a living? He's some fancy-pants attorney?"
"He's a PI like me. Semi-retired. He was laid up for a while with a knee replacement." Mentally, I crossed my eyes. The way I was describing Dietz made him sound like some old geezer who could barely walk. In truth, Dietz had been gone so long that my claiming him as a boyfriend was patently ridiculous.
"Sounds old."
"He's not. He's only 53. Tommy smiled to himself.
Now see? I knew you'd be the type to go for somebody old. What are you, 35?
36.
I'm 28 myself, which I figure is prime for a guy," he remarked. He lifted his head slightly. "Here comes Richard."
"How do you do that? I didn't hear him pull in."
"Radar," he said.
He got to his feet and stood there for a moment, running a critical eye along the baseboard.
"I miss any spots?"
"Not as far as I can see." Tommy found the lid for the can of paint and tapped along the edges to effect a seal. Richard appeared in the doorway wearing a long black raincoat with the ends of the belt tied together in the back. He wasn't nearly as appealing as his brother and certainly not as friendly, meeting my gaze with only an occasional flicker of his eyes.
"I thought you had something else to do today," he said to Tommy.
"Yeah, well, I wanted to finish this. I don't like leaving a job until I know it's done right." Tommy delivered his lines without looking at his brother. There was something edgy going on between them, but I couldn't figure out what it was. They seemed chilly with each other, as though their current conversation were part of an ongoing argument. Tommy went into the bathroom where I could hear him running water to clean his paintbrush. He came out moments later and began to gather up his tools. It felt like a replay of the night I'd first seen the place, except that neither of them spoke. "Let me write you that check," I said, trying to inject a warmer note. I reached from my bag and took out the checkbook and a pen, leaning against the wall while I filled in the date. "Heavener Properties, Inc.,
"That's right."
Richard stood with his hands in his raincoat pockets, watching me idly as I wrote in the amount. Meanwhile, as Tommy headed for the door, I saw the two exchange a glance. His gaze moved to mine, and he smiled at me fleetingly before he disappeared through the door. I ripped the check from the book and handed it to Richard, who removed the lease from the inner pocket of his raincoat. He'd already filled in the relevant blanks. I began to read through the lines of minuscule print while Richard studied me.
"I hope he's not bothering you."
"Who, Tommy?" "Not at all. We were chatting about the deck. I stopped by to take some measurements.
I'd like to put in some shelves. Of course. Everything look okay to you? Fine. He did a great job. When are you moving?
I'm hoping the early part of next week.
Good. Here's my card. I'm the one you should call if you need anything.
I turned my attention to the lease agreement, reading it line by line. Seemed like standard fare. No tricks, no hidden clauses, no unusual restrictions. Richard was watching me read.
What kind of cases do you handle?
Just about anything. It varies. Right now I'm looking into the disappearance of a doctor who's been gone for nearly 10 weeks. January, I did a search for a missing heir.
Mostly local?
For the most part, yes. Occasionally I go out of state, but it's usually cheaper for a client to hire a PI in their own geographic area. That way they don't have to pay travel, which can really add up. I scribbled my name at the bottom of the lease, handed him one copy, and kept the other for my files. I'm always saying this, but the job's a lot duller than it sounds. Background checks and paper searches at the Hall of Records. I used to be associated with an insurance company handling arson and wrongful death claims, but I prefer being out on my own. I didn't want to appear shiftless, so I omitted the fact that CF had fired my sorry butt. I hoped he wouldn't press the point because I didn't want to lie to him this early in the game. He said,
"Well, I better give you a key."
He dug in his raincoat pocket and pulled out a ring, sorting through 10 to 15 keys until he found the one he wanted. He freed it and dropped it in the palm of my hand.
"You might want to get a second one made in case you lose this."
"I'll do that. Thanks." I took out my key ring and added it to my modest collection. After he departed, I pulled out my tape measure and began to lay out the dimensions of the room. The spaces between windows, depth of the closet, distance to the door. I made a crude drawing on my legal pad, and then I sat in the middle of the carpet tapping on my lip with my pencil while I studied the room. Between the smell of new carpet and the scent of fresh paint, the office seemed as clean and as slick as a brand new car. Outside the window, the day was dreary, but inside, where I was, there was a sense of new beginnings. I was just about to pack up when the phone rang. I must have jumped a foot, and then I stared at the instrument. Someone looking for Richard or Tommy couldn't be for me. I picked up on the fifth ring, feeling hesitant. "Hello?" The drawl again.
"Hey, it's me. My brother still there?"
"He just left."
"I thought maybe the two of us might go out for a drink."
His voice on the phone was low and flirtatious. I could tell he was smiling, holding the handset close to his lips.
"Why?" "Why?" His laugh bubbled up. "Why do you think?"
"Is there a problem between you and Richard?"
"Such as what?"
"I don't know. I got the feeling he didn't like the fact that you were talking to me. So, you know, you asked me out for a drink, and I'm not sure it's wise."
"You're a tenant. He's strict. That still doesn't make it any of his damn business."
"I don't want to get you in trouble."
He laughed. "Don't worry about it. I can take care of myself."
"I didn't mean it that way. I don't want to cause problems."
"I told you, it's not a problem. Quit trying to duck the question and let me buy you a glass of wine."
"It's only 4 o'clock.
"So?"
"I have work to do yet."
"When will you finish?"
"Probably closer to 6.
"Good. We'll make it dinner instead."
"Not dinner, a drink, and only one," I said.
"You're calling the shots. Name the place and I'll be there."
I thought for a moment, tempted by the idea of Rosie's, which was off the beaten path. This all felt faintly sneaky, like it wouldn't be good for Richard to see us together. Still, I couldn't see the harm in having one drink. "There's a place near the beach," I said, and gave him Rosie's address. "You know where that is?"
"I'll find it.
I may be late.
I'll wait."
After I hung up, I wondered if I'd made a mistake. It's not a smart move to mix the professional with the personal. He was my landlord now, and if anything went wrong, I'd be looking for new digs. On the other hand, I was friendly with Lonnie Kingman, and that hadn't presented any problems. It did cheer me up, the notion of seeing him again. With luck, he'd turn out to be a jerk, and I'd politely decline any further contact. In the meantime, I knew I had to get down to the business of Dow Purcell. I'd go back to square one. starting at Pacific Meadows and the night he vanished from the face of the earth. This time the parking lot at Pacific Meadows was full. I tucked my VW in the very last slot on the left, squeezing up against the hedge. I locked my car and slopped through shallow puddles to the front door. The wind was blowing at my back and my leather boots were water-stained by the time I reached shelter. I leaned my umbrella against the wall and hung my slicker on a peg. Today, the air smelled of tomato sauce, carnations, damp wool socks, potting soil, baby powder. I checked the dinner menu posted on the wall near the double dining room doors. Barbecued riblet, baked beans, broccoli and cauliflower medley. Now there was a winner. And for dessert, gelatin with fruit cocktail. I hoped it was cherry, clearly the superior flavor for any age group. As this was a weekday, there seemed to be more residents moving about in the hall. The day room was nearly full. The drapes had been closed and the room felt cozier. One group watched a television news show, while another group watched a black-and-white movie with Ida Lupino and George Raft. In the far corner, a middle-aged woman was leading six elderly female residents in an exercise program, which consisted of lifting their arms and marching their feet while they remained seated in folding chairs. The human body was meant for motion, and this small group of women was still doing what they could to keep fit. Hooray for them! I nodded at the woman at the front desk, behaving as though I were an old hand at this. Unchallenged, I proceeded to administration, where I found Mary laying out a hand of solitaire. She looked up with guilt, pulled the cards together, and quickly slid them into her pencil drawer. She said, "Hi! How are you?" I could tell she'd recognized my face, but was drawing a blank on the name. "Kinsey Milhone," I said. "I thought I'd stop by and see if Mrs. Stegler was here. I hope she hasn't left for the day." Mary pointed to her right just as a woman emerged from the inner office with a pair of gardening clippers and a cluster of bald and brownish ivy vines. She was saying, "That looks much better. Dr. P. would never allow me to tend to his plants when he was here." She was slightly disconcerted to see me, but she continued on to the wastebasket where she deposited her prunings. Her hair was bushy on top and cut quite short around the ears. She wore an oversized brown blazer, a shirt, a tie, and a pair of mannish pants. She had a gold silk cravat bunched in the breast pocket of her jacket. The toes of her brown Oxfords peered from beneath her shapeless trouser legs. She could have used another 2 inches in the length. "Mrs. Stegler, my name's Kinsey Milhone. I'm hoping you can give me some information about Dr. Purcell." She plucked a tissue from the box on Mary's desk and wiped her hands carefully before she finally offered to shake hands. "Mary said you stopped by on Saturday. I'm not certain I can be of help. I make it a policy not to discuss my employer without his express permission." "I understand that," I said. "I'm not asking you to violate a confidence. You know Fiona Purcell?" "Of course, Dr. Purcell's first wife." "She hired me in hopes I could get a line on him. I'm actually here at her suggestion. She felt a conversation with you was the logical place to begin." Mrs. Stegler shook her head. "I'm sorry, but I was gone by the time the doctor left the building that night," she said almost stubbornly. I could tell she was happy she had nothing to contribute on the subject. "Did you talk to him that day?" Mrs. Stegler gave me a significant look and signaled with her eyes that Mary was listening to every word we said. "Perhaps you'd like to step into his office. We can talk in there." She held open the hinged section of the counter, and I passed inside. Her eyes were as small and as round as a parakeet's, a pale, watery blue with a ring of black around the iris. As we entered the inner office, she turned to Mary. "Please see that we are not disturbed." Mary said, "Yes, ma'am," rolling her eyes at no one in particular. For my part, I was intrigued by the opportunity to see Dr. Purcell's office, which was small and neat. Desk, swivel chair, two upholstered guest chairs, and a bookcase filled with medical textbooks and assorted healthcare manuals. On the edge of his desk sat the newly shorn ivy, looking like a cocker spaniel with a summer clip. I'd have given a lot for the chance to go through his desk drawers, but the chances of that looked dim. It was clear Mrs. Stegler thought it inappropriate to sit at his desk. She perched on one of his guest chairs, and I took the other,
which put us nearly knee to knee. She scooted her chair back and crossed her legs, exposing a band of narrow, white, hairless shin above the rim of her wool sock. I said, "I hope this doesn't seem out of line, but I have to tell you, I can't stand gossip. Even in my line of work, I never encourage anyone to talk out of turn or breach a trust, especially in a matter like this." She looked at me with a hint of suspicion, perhaps sensing the bullshit, perhaps not. "We're in accord on that. I'd appreciate your telling me about his last day at work." "I explained all that to the police, more than once, I might add."
"I'm hoping you'll explain it again to me. Detective Odessa told me you were very helpful."
She peered uneasily at my shoulder bag resting on the floor by my chair. "You're not recording this." I leaned over, grabbed the bag, and held it open so she could inspect the contents. The only thing that looked even vaguely like a recorder was my government-issue secret plastic tampon container with its high-powered directional mic.
"And you won't quote me out of context?"
"I won't quote you at all." She was silent, staring down at her lap. Finally, she said, "I've been divorced for years." She was silent again, and I allowed the subject to sit there between us without comment on my part or elucidation on hers. I could see that she was struggling to speak. Her face twisted suddenly, her lips pulling together as though controlled by invisible strings. She spoke, but her voice was so tight and so raspy I could hardly understand what she said.
"Dr. Purcell was the closest thing to a friend I had. I can't believe he's gone. I came into work the following Monday morning, and by then everyone was whispering that he was missing. I was shocked. He was such a sweet man. I so adored him. If I'd known that was the last time I was going to see him, I would have expressed my heartfelt thanks for all his many, many kindnesses to me."
She took another deep breath, humming with a kind of sorrow that didn't lend itself to words. After half a minute, she seemed to regain her composure, though her grip was clearly fragile. She removed the cravat from her breast pocket and blew her nose noisily. The silk didn't seem absorbent. She folded her hands together in her lap, the wadded cloth between her fingers where she twisted it. I could see a tear plop into her lap, and then a second, like a slow drip from a shower handle that hasn't been properly turned off. I realized she was the first person, aside from Blanche, who'd shown any real emotional reaction to his vanishing. I leaned forward and clutched her cold hands. "I know this is hard. Take your time." She took a deep breath.
"Forgive me. I'm sorry. I shouldn't burden you this way. I just hope he's safe. I don't care what he's done."
She paused, pressing the cravat against her lips. She took another deep breath.
"I'm fine now. I'm fine. I don't know what came over me. My apologies."
"I understand. From everything I've heard, he was a wonderful man. My only purpose here is to help. You have to trust me on that. I'm not here to make trouble."
"What do you want?"
"Just tell me what you know." She hesitated, her no-gossip policy too deeply ingrained to give up all at once. She must have decided to trust me because she took a deep breath and opened up.
"The last day, he seemed preoccupied. I think he was worried. I mean, why wouldn't he be? Mrs. Purcell, excuse me, the first one, Fiona, stopped by to see him, but he'd gone out to lunch. She waited for a while, thinking he might return, and then she left him a note. When he came back, he worked in his office for the rest of the day. I remember he had a glass of whiskey sitting at his desk. This was late in the day."
"Did he go out for dinner?"
"I don't believe so. He usually ate quite late or skipped supper altogether. Many evenings he had a little something at his desk, crackers or fruit. This was if his wife was going out and wouldn't be cooking. When I tapped on his door to say goodnight, he was just sitting there."
"Did he have papers in front of him, files or charts?"
"He must have. I didn't pay attention. It wasn't in his nature to be idle. I do know that."
"You had a conversation?"
The usual pleasantries, nothing significant.
Any phone calls or visitors that you know of?
She shook her head.
Not that I remember. When I came in the following Monday, his office was empty. Highly unusual for him. He was always here at 7 o'clock, before anyone else. By then the rumors were beginning to circulate. Someone, I forget who, said he'd never gone home at all on Friday night. At first we didn't attach much to it. Then people got worried he'd been in an accident or taken ill. When the police came, we were frightened, but we still expected him to be found within a day or two. I've thought and thought about this, but there's absolutely nothing else.
Didn't I read in the paper he had a brief chat that night with an elderly woman sitting in the lobby?
That would be Mrs. Kurtzinger, Ruby. She's been a resident here since 1975. I'll have Mary take you over to her room. I don't want you upsetting her.
I promise. I won't. Chapter 11. Mary walked me down the hall. I could see the meal carts being rolled out, the vertical shelves stacked with dinner trays for those who preferred eating in their rooms. It was not even 5 o'clock, and I suspected the early supper hour was designed to condense all three of the day's meals to one long shift. Mary was saying,
"Remember the nurse who was standing there when you left on Saturday? Her name's Pepper Gray. Anyway, she started asking all these questions about you. I never led on a thing, just said you'd be back to talk to Mrs. S. today. She read me out good, saying I shouldn't be talking to anyone about the clinic. I was so PO'd. She doesn't have any right to talk to me that way. She doesn't even work in my department."
"What do you think she heard?"
"Doesn't matter. It's none of her business. I just thought you should be aware of it in case we run into her."
We took a left, passing the staff lounge, central supply, and then a series of residential rooms. Many doors were closed, the exteriors decorated with greeting cards or wreaths of dried flowers. Sometimes the names of the occupants were spelled out in foil letters, hanging jauntily from a mini clothesline of ribbon or string. Through the doors that remained open, I caught glimpses of twin-sized beds with floral spreads. Photographs of family members lined up on the chests of drawers. Each room had a different color scheme, and each looked out onto a narrow garden where flowering shrubs trembled with the first drops of a pattering rain. We passed an old woman, stumping down the hall with her walker. Her pace was rapid, and when she reached the corner, she turned with such vigor she threatened to topple sideways. Mary reached out a hand and steadied her. The woman banked, swerving wide, and then tottered on. Ruby Kurtzinger was sitting in an upholstered chair beside a set of sliding glass doors, one of which was pushed back to admit a breath of damp, fresh air. Her feet were propped on a stool. Just outside, a bird feeder was suspended from the eaves. Small brown birds were perched on the feeder's edge. A line of birds like clothespins extended from the hanging support. Ruby was a tiny, shrunken woman with a small, bony face and arms as thin as sticks. Her white hair was sparse, but it looked as if she'd recently had it washed and set. She turned a pair of bright blue eyes toward us and smiled, showing the many gaps in her lower teeth. Mary introduced us and explained what I wanted before she withdrew. Ruby said,
"You should talk to Charles. He saw Dr. Purcell after I said good night to him."
"I don't think I've heard of Charles."
"He's an orderly on the night staff. He's probably here somewhere. He likes to come in to work early so he can visit with Mrs. Thornton and some of the other girls. They play gin rummy for pennies, and you should hear them hoot. When I have trouble sleeping, I ring for him, and he'll put me in my chair and push me up and down the halls. Sometimes I sit in the staff lounge and play euchre with him. The man does love to play cards. I take my meals here in my room. There are folks in the dining room I don't much care for. One woman chews with her mouth open. I don't want to look at that when I'm eating. It's disgusting. The night you're asking about when I last saw the doctor, I took my usual pills, but nothing seemed to help. I rang for Charles, and he said he'd take me on Toad's Wild Ride. That's what he calls it. In truth, he wanted to smoke, so he parked me in the lobby and went outside. That's why I was sitting there, so Charles could sneak a cigarette. He's trying to quit, and I guess he thinks if no one knows what he's doing, it won't count. Dr. Purcell doesn't allow anyone to smoke in here. He says too many people have problems breathing as it is. That's one thing we talked about that night.
What time was this?
9:05 or so. We didn't chat long.
Can you remember anything else?
He told me I was beautiful. He always says that to me, though. I sometimes think he's fibbing just a tiny bit. I asked about his boy. I forget what his name is.
Griffith.
That's it. Doctor used to have his wife bring the little boy in to see us every week or so. Of course, she hasn't brought him even once since his daddy disappeared. I noticed the child's feet scarcely ever touched the floor. They carried him every place, and anything he wanted, he pointed to and grunted. I told the doctor, he's never going to learn to talk as long as you treat him that way, and he heartily agreed. And then we talked about the weather. It was a lovely night outside, felt just like spring, and I believe the moon was almost full. He went through the door, and that's the last I saw of him.
Could you tell what kind of mood he was in? Mad? Sad? She put an index finger against her cheek and gave that some thought. Arthritis had bent the thumb on that hand until it formed a painful-looking angle perpendicular to her hand.
Absent-minded, I'd say. I had to ask him twice if he could arrange an outing for us. The food here is good. I don't mean to complain, but eating out is fun and gives us all a lift. Any little change makes such a difference.
A Hispanic woman in scrubs appeared at the door. I have your dinner tray, Mrs. Kurtzinger. You want to eat in front of the TV so you can watch your show? It's coming on in 5 minutes, and you don't want to miss the opening. That's the best part, you said. She crossed to Ruby's chair and set the dinner tray on a small rolling table that she pulled in close. She removed the aluminum lid, revealing the barbecued riblet laid out with all its accompaniments. The jello was green with a smattering of fruit cocktail submerged in its glowing depths.
Thank you, Ruby said,
and then she smiled at me.
Will you come back and see me, dear? I like talking to you.
I'll do what I can. Tell you what, next time I'll bring you a quarter pounder with cheese.
And a Big Mac. Oh, I see those ads on television, and they always look so good.
Believe me, they are. I'll bring you one of those, too. I walked down the hall as far as the staff lounge, where I stuck my head in and said, I'm looking for Charles. The man I saw sitting at the table with the evening paper was in his 50s and was dressed in scrubs, like the woman bringing out the trays. He was a mild nut brown and narrow through the shoulders, his arms hairless and scrawny. He set his paper aside and got to his feet politely to identify himself. Charles Beidler, he said. How may I help you, miss? I explained who I was and what I wanted, repeating the gist of what Ruby Kurtzinger had told me. I know you've answered these questions before, but it would really be a help if you'd tell me what you remember. I could show you where he was parked and where I stood that night. I'd love that, I said. He picked up a folded section of the paper and carried it with him as we moved toward the entrance. I paused to retrieve my umbrella and my slicker, which I held over my head like a yellow plastic tent. Charles used his newspaper as a rain hat, and we hurried outside, hunched against the rain, which was blowing against us in gusts. Charles paused at the end of the walkway, pointing toward the cars. See where that little blue VW is parked? Dr. Space was right there. I saw him crossing the lot, and then he got in his car and pulled out right around to here. You didn't see anyone else?
No. But now that corner of the parking lot was darker at 9 o'clock than it is right now. Warm that night. I was in my shirt sleeves like this, only without the goose flesh. I spoke to him like always, you know, calling out a word, and he said something back, kind of bantering-like.
There was nothing unusual?
Not as I recall.
I'm trying to see this as you did. Ruby says he had his suit jacket over his arm. Did he carry anything else?
I don't think so. I can't picture it if he did.
What about his car keys?
I guess he must have had those in hand. I don't remember him reaching in his pocket.
So he unlocked the car door, and then what?
I don't remember nothing about that.
Did the interior light go on?
Might have. After he got in, he sat a while, and then he started up the engine and swung around this way so he could drive out the front.
Was that his pattern? Charles blinked, shaking his head.
Most times.
His newspaper was getting soaked, and I knew it was time to retreat to the overhang. Let's get out of this rain, I said. We headed back to the entrance, pausing again just outside the front door. I said, was there anything else, anything at all, even if it seems trivial?
He didn't call out good night like he usually did when he drove past. Last thing he'd do, he used to wave and shake a finger, kind of teasing me like, because I told him I quit smoking.
Was the car window down?
I couldn't say for sure.
You didn't see anyone in the car with him? Charles shook his head. Are you sure?
Pretty sure. And truthfully, that's as much as I know.
Well, I appreciate your time. If you should think of anything else, would you give me a call? I took a business card from my bag and handed it to him. I can be reached at this number. There's a machine if I'm gone. As I left the porch and started out across the parking lot, I turned and waved. Charles was still there, staring after me. I sat in my car for a while, thinking about the fact that I was parked right where Dow Purcell had been on the night of September 12th. I did a 180 survey, turning my head. What had happened to him? The rain kept tapping on my car roof, like the restless drumming of fingers on a tabletop. He hadn't been assaulted. He'd gotten in his car and he'd sat there a while. Doing what? I started the car and backed out of the space, heading, as Purcell had, toward Dave Levine Street. I glanced back at the building. Charles was gone by then. The walk was empty, and the rain slanting against the light made the entrance seem bleak. I turned right, scanning the street on either side of me. The area was residential. St. Terry's Hospital was only 4 blocks away. There were medical buildings in the surrounding area, apartment buildings, and a few private homes, but not much else. No bars or restaurants along this stretch where he might have stopped for a drink. Once I reached the next intersection, it was impossible to guess which way he might have gone. I circled back to the office, and by 5:30 I was typing up a rough draft of the next installment of my report. It helped to be forced to lay it all out in narrative form. I'd done an additional 4 hours of work, which I deducted from the balance of the retainer, leaving me $1,125 of indentured servitude. I could feel anxiety whispering through my bones. I was no wiser now than I'd been when I first started, and probably no closer to finding Dr. Purcell. I didn't even have a scheme, no clever strategy about how to proceed. What more could I do? Fiona wanted results. I was moving, but getting nowhere. I checked my watch. 6:02. I leaped to my feet. I was already late for Rosie's, but it couldn't be helped. I shoved the report in my handbag, thinking I could work on it later if I needed to. Traffic was heavy on the rain-slick streets. While stuck at a stoplight, I turned the rearview mirror to check my appearance. I seldom wear makeup, so I looked much the same, sallow by the light of street lamps, my hair a dense thatch of brown. I felt less than glamorous in my jeans and turtleneck, but it couldn't be helped. I didn't have time to go home and change. Into what? I don't have anything else. This is what I wear. I parked my car in front of my apartment and dog-trotted the half-block to Rosie's. I pushed open the door, dumped my umbrella, and left my slicker on a peg. Where Friday night the place had been emptied by the weather, tonight it was jammed. Both the jukebox and the television were going full blast. Monday night football having captured a rowdy cluster of sports enthusiasts at the bar. The cigarette smoke was dense and all the tables were taken. I saw William emerge from the kitchen with a tray at shoulder height, while Rosie was uncapping beer bottles as fast as she could. I searched the crowd, wondering if I'd managed to arrive before Tommy Heavener. I felt a plucking at my sleeve and looked down to find him looking up at me from the first booth on the right. Oh, my. He was freshly shaved, and he changed into a white dress shirt with a sky-blue wool crew neck pulled over it. He said something.